Hey listeners, just a little trigger warning here. In this episode, we discuss sexual misconduct in the workplace and some pretty uncomfortable scenarios in a professional setting. We wanted you to know this in advance, and please take care when listening to this episode. If you decide to skip, that's totally okay too. Please also know that we have some useful information and resources in the show notes for anyone who may be dealing with this in their own life. Now, on to the show.
So I started going to the office at 5, 6 a.m. in the morning because I would be the only one there, because that was acceptable to me rather than staying late, because I know what happens when I stay late. And as I am leading this competition project, it became increasingly hard for my peers to take me seriously, because according to them, I was just handed the leadership opportunity since this partner has an affinity for me.
This is Red Lines by Out of Architecture. The experiences that isolate us in our working world are also the stories that can unite our community and allow us to heal. In this series, we dive deeper into the core issues that plague the design profession and evaluate how they result in everyday conflict, discomfort, and workplace turmoil.
We are your hosts, Jake Rudin and Aaron Pellegrino, the founders of Out of Architecture, a career resource network for architects and designers looking to find greater fulfillment in their work and help navigating the many challenges within the profession. Through our work, we've spoken with thousands of individuals, all with unique pathways and experiences.
Too often in this work, we encounter stories of struggle, tension, and suffering. Red Lines seeks to bring a voice to these stories, those privately endured in a school or a workplace, but often clouded by shame, self-doubt, and the questioning of one's professional choices. With each episode, we will ask a member of our community to share their story, we'll offer some guidance and advice, and discuss ways to move forward. For the purposes of maintaining confidentiality, names and some identifiable characteristics have been removed or replaced with pseudonyms. Their stories, however, are all too real.
On this episode of Red Lines, we speak to Lara about her struggles to get clear guidance, support, and the correct documentation for her visa program while studying at an elite architecture school, one that promised to support her through a technical degree program. We also discuss the various types of exploitation, abuses, and insecurities that follow young architects who come to the U.S. on a visa, intending to stay and work in the country. Lara, thank you for joining us today on Red Lines.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate being here.
I want to begin with our very first question that we ask at the start of every episode, which is, what are you hoping people will take away from your story today?
There have been several challenges that I have had to face in this ambition to move to and practice architecture in the U.S. And I'm hoping when faced with similar challenges, someone can find some comfort or guidance and not feel alone and helpless while going through similar situations.
We really want to thank you for coming here and speaking with us today. I think we'd like to just start by giving you the time and the space to tell us a little bit more about your story.
I studied architecture and practiced for a few years in my home country, and there was a desire to kind of move to this side of the world, which is leading in technology, in practice, in a lot of the ways. I decided to move to the U.S. And the best way that I could figure out to practice as an architect in the country was to go for technical program that provided NCARB accreditation. And so while evaluating various courses at various schools, that was a big item that I had in my mind to eventually get licensed and be able to practice as a designated architect. And after careful consideration, I picked the program that I did. Another layer of decision-making that was added on top of it was the city that the university would be located in, because based on my past experiences, that plays a huge role. And also I know what kind of student or learner I am, and proximity to just seeing different projects helps a whole lot rather than just being sitting and studying in studio. So that's how I ended up accepting the admission offer that I got from a great institution, which was located in Chicago.
when you were training, you completed your bachelor's degree there. Did you spend any time working as an architect?
Yes, I did. It was very important to me to get hands-on experience. So I actually had started working since I was in second year of my undergraduate degree. And though a lot of those were summer internships, part-time work, till I was in my fourth year, where one of my design studio professors actually hired me after summer internship and seeing my work to work with them part-time whenever my study schedule and class schedule allowed. So I was supporting them in a practice that they had recently set up. And then they ended up hiring me full-time after that as well. So I kind of had a similar desire when I moved to the US, again, having some background and not being an absolutely fresh person to this realm. I wanted to kind of sink my teeth into the professional aspect of things, but that turned out to be a lot more challenging than I could have originally anticipated.
What were some of your expectations when you decided you were going to come to the US, you were going to do a master's degree, and you chose this university not just for a location, I'm assuming, but also for its relationship to that desire to both learn and practice?
One of the reasons I chose to be at this particular university was that it was because of the technical nature of the course that they provided, which in my experience was incredibly hard to find, because at the time I was enrolling, there was a huge shift and focus on computational design and digital fabrication design. And a lot of courses were geared towards that. Whereas I understand that being an international student comes with its fair share of challenges, where you're not just getting accustomed to a new city, you're not just getting accustomed to the way education is done here, but there's also a layer of being very far away from everything you know and just being thrown into this mix. So I gave myself the first couple of semesters to just gather as much information as I can, absorb as much as I possibly can to be at a better standing, see what or if there are any differences in the industry jargon just based on the physical differences of location, languages, and things like that. And once I completed my first year of the program, again, it was a shorter program just because I had already done a five-year degree course. It was only a two-year program, and I did not want to delay it any further, even though there was that option to kind of take lower credit and elongate it if people wanted to, because I wanted to get into the profession and into the professional side of things. However, there is a requirement for international students to register and enroll with the USCIS for curriculum practical training while you are on a student visa or an F1 status holder at any university. Now, there are some guidelines from the USCIS and restrictions as to who can apply for this CPT program and when. According to those, it's very clearly prescribed that you have had to have completed at least two semesters of studying to be able to be eligible to apply for that. And while I was trying to get that paperwork together, it came to my attention that I was not eligible, or the university flagged me as not eligible for that. And when I tried to ask questions, it was told that the university eligibility is that I need to have been a student for four consecutive semesters before applying for this program.
It's always incredible to hear the commitment and dedication of international students, not only to come to the US, but to architecture as a profession. They have to contend with both the difference in culture and language that new students have to face, and the loneliness of the physical distance from home. Even more incredible are the bureaucratic barriers that work to prevent them from staying in our country and adding to the rich mix of people that live here and comprise the architecture community. And this is something that is unique to this university, ostensibly? What did you end up finding out?
I ended up finding out that this was unique to this particular university. Whether that is the case at some other institution, I don't know. I am not aware. But when I tried to dig further about why this other layer is there, when USCIS says I'm eligible, why do I have to be eligible through the university? Like, how come it varies or differs? It was very hard finding someone with answers. And I kept getting bounced around from one department to the other. So I went to the College of Architecture Administrative Services at the university, and they informed me that this is out of their realm and I should go speak to Career Services, which I did, who then told me that this is out of their scope of knowledge and expertise, and then I should go to International Affairs, which I did. From there, I was further told that they enforce this, but they are not the governing body who makes these rules. So I should go to the Office of Global Services. I did. And once I went there, it became abundantly clear that there is no one person who could provide me an answer because they are not the individuals who are involved in drafting all of these requirements and rules, but they're the ones enforcing them. So I set up a meeting with the director of global services at that university. And it was not so great being in a room with someone who is unwilling to take you seriously and just being like, I don't understand or see the problem here. We've had this for so many years. How come you're the only person who's raised this issue? And once I spoke about my desire, and there was a lot of international students in my program, I voiced my concerns to them, and a few fellow students joined me as well, saying that this is not okay. So I went back again with three of us at this point, voicing our concerns. And they said, well, if this is so much of an issue, we can look into it. However, nothing is going to change today and now. Thank you for bringing this to our attention.
To be super clear, this was a level of bureaucracy or a layer of red tape that was added on by the university. It conflicted with the base requirements for the CPT as set out, you know, essentially the United States. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes.
And it sounds like, I mean, you've gone through an individual unit department, then the institutional department, then the international, then the global. Unless there's a director of galactic services at the university, we really don't have anyone else to support you. And it sounds like nobody is taking responsibility. How did that make you feel after having chosen and spent a year of your allotted visa time at this university, having paid for a technical program that's supposed to be supporting burgeoning architects?
It was very disheartening. And not just that, the fact that none of these requirements or rules were made clear upfront, which I would hope that universities would do, especially considering the volume of international students that they get. And it was felt even worse because I had already gone through the process of applying and looking for internships. And not to say that that was a challenge in itself, because I did not have any local experience. And I had my professors write recommendation letters. So I had not just, you know, put in my time and effort, but I had also called in favors and asked them to invest their time in providing me all of this, which it just felt like an incredible waste. And again, I'm not going to go into the details of the internship that was unpaid, because I never even accepted it. I legally could not. So I was going to have to like dig into my pocket and savings to get some professional experience. But the fact that even when I was willing to take that on, this particular rule or layer of another thing hampered me from even taking that step.
Speaking of savings, I mean, part of the F1 visa is that students under CPT are allowed to work and earn income as long as they're undergoing practical training in that area, correct? And I imagine that you know, as much as gaining experience is a big motivator, paying your tuition and bills in this country is probably also an equally big motivation for you.
Absolutely. And at that point, I was very promptly informed that I could take an on-campus job if that's my motivation, which is whatever your minimum wage. So I actually ended up taking an administrative job in the dean's office because that's all I could do till like one of the professors who taught a particular course, which was a professional practice course that I did incredibly well in, asked me to TA for them.
I just want to also unpack this and set the scene. The school was essentially saying that instead of the typical 1 year waiting period, it was now a 2 year or 4 semester waiting period. And based on what you've said so far, or what I understand of what you've said so far, that was the entirety of your program. You did a 2 year program. So in theory, this sort of hurdle would render all of your time in school, I don't want to say wasted, but you could not actually be doing the training portion of the CPT program under the rules of the university, ostensibly. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. And again, they had me meet with a career advisor suggesting that if gaining professional or practical experience or training is something that is important to me, I can elongate my course. And essentially, the number of credits that I need in order to graduate a degree, which I can back it in 4 semesters, but I could also elongate that to 6 or 8 semesters. So I would be paying tuition much longer, essentially.
So what you're saying in so many words that Aaron and I can say explicitly is the university put in a longer period to prevent students from going out to get CPT, both to not only encourage them to take lower paying university jobs for that early part of their time at the university, but also to extend their time at the university, thereby paying more tuition in and increasing the amount of money that was going to this particular institution, or so one might assume.
Now, to be clear, this is a conclusion that we have drawn and a statement that we don't make lightly. At this point, with all the people we've spoken to at Out of Architecture and just our time in the profession, nothing really surprises us anymore, including the possibility that a university could take advantage of the fact that in a program such as this, students can be forced to stay longer, pay more tuition, and work for lower pay in order to complete something that is tied to their visa status.
We'll let you draw or any listeners their own conclusions, but this is what I was faced with. And not just me, I do know of some people in my course who actually did end up opting for that option.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's not a lot of other alternatives.
So after having, you know, gone through all of this process and essentially not being able to practice or get any professional practical experience in the field, I was even more motivated getting close to graduation to do as much as I possibly can to better my chances of landing a good job, and not just a good job, but a one that I would learn at, knowing very well that I have essentially a 1 year period to sell my value to any employer so that they would support or sponsor my H-1B, which is a work visa. So for people that don't know, OPT is optional practical training, which is kind of a given with your student status or right after your student status. It is essentially an extension of the same visa type. And it can be anywhere from a 1 year period to a 3 year period. And the only difference, or the way that it's outlined within the US government rules, is whether that falls under STEM or STEAM degree or not. However, it was later that I realized that the STEM degree has got nothing to do with your coursework or what you're actually being taught, but is an application that has to be filled out by the university to apply for it.
Well, what did you think you were signing up for when you took on this degree program?
I hoped or assumed that since it's a more technical degree, that it would fall under the category and hence lead me to a 3-year OPT versus a 1-year. But those rose-tinted glasses came off way too late in the process, once bitten, twice shy, right? So after going through the whole CPT debacle, I started diving deeper into what other restrictions there might be. And that's when I came across this. But at that point, I had already invested not just time, but a significant amount of money into this program to leave it midway or look for other options. So I did what was in my control at the time and started very incredibly rigorously job hunting while in my final semester, before that was even on the radar for most other people.
You had practiced before you had gotten your, you know, your bachelor's back home. You had done research in choosing this program in this university as the one that was going to be, you know, tick all of these boxes and set you up in the way that you wanted to be. In what ways did the literature from the school or how the program was advertised, were they potentially unclear? Essentially, I want to know if you were misled in understanding what you could get out of the program versus what they actually allowed you to do.
I wouldn't say misled. I think I would say that there was a lack of information regarding all of this. And in hindsight, when I did sign on, I didn't even know to ask these questions. My background is not in law, definitely not in immigration law. Unless you're in the thick of it, you don't even realize that these are things that might come into play. And I feel like that was a similar situation. And I knew people at different universities, some at the same time, some that had graduated earlier. And when I would discuss things with them, it became abundantly clear that the time or resources being invested by the university to kind of help the international students is minimal at this place. There were no clear answers. And after my stint with the whole CPT thing, once I went back asking this question, I was just met with, "Oh, it's you again. So what issue is it this time?" And just being like, "We have so many students and so many international students. How come it's only you coming up with all of these issues? Are others not facing it, or are they not saying anything?"
That must have been an incredibly demeaning and frustrating point to have thrown in your face over and over again. Because I think the answer to "is it only you" is it doesn't matter. The fact is that I'm coming to ask these questions to support my goals. And if other people have the flexibility to pay 8 semesters of tuition, good on them, you know? But that isn't the point here. The point is, why are the rules different for me than they are for others around the country? If I'm coming to you, you know, with these questions, why aren't you supporting me? Why aren't you, you know, trusting that if I'm asking questions that you don't have the answers to, that doesn't mean they're bad questions, right? I think that is a super important point here, and one that we find clients bringing to us very often throughout of architecture. You know, it's hard to feel isolated and to be asking for support. And I think you sharing this narrative is really helpful and will hopefully help empower some students, whether they're going through this, you know, exact scenario or whether they're even just going through a struggle of their own, to kind of come forward and ask questions and feel justified in asking for that support.
I had been warned before I decided to move to the US about the whole H-1B struggle and that being a lottery. And, you know, it's very hard to kind of live or plan your life in any possible way when you constantly have this like ticking clock on your head where it's a lottery. You don't know the way things are going to go. And I was warned about that, which I always had at the back of my head. Hence why I wanted to get as much hands-on experience while I still possibly had the time. And I was met with one hurdle after the other. And not just that, even being in university, like most architecture schools, specifically design studios, there is a lot of group work because you're be meant to learn in a team setting because that's how things in the profession actually happen. You're never in isolation. You're always a part of an incredibly large consultant team, depending on the project sizes. It was very challenging to work with people who are not in the same boat or not faced with same challenges, but work around the schedule of others who had a job or sometimes two jobs. Meanwhile, I was met with, well, you don't have anything else to do, so why can't you be here like after 10 p.m.? Because you don't have anything else to do. We have jobs. And that in itself was so incredibly demeaning because I'm not sitting on my hands because I don't want to do a job or because I can't get one, because there are so many factors preventing me from it. But I'm not going to go and, you know, cry a river in front of my peers. So I just kept a strong face and I was like, okay, I guess I will work around you.
This just feels like a failure at several levels. One, of your peers to recognize the situation you were in and grant you the sort of grace and humility, particularly as someone who's come to another country and, you know, could probably benefit from at least the healthy parts of a community that architecture school can offer. But then also even the lack of support from the university, which frankly, they work for you. You pay tuition. These support services are there for the students. So to be met with a sort of disdain because you're asking them to do their job, and then to also be met with incredulity and a lack of support from your peers is disheartening. And I'm just so sorry that that happened to you.
It was very disheartening, but it also kind of lit this fire in me to prove myself and to do better. I did end up receiving more than one certificate and scholarship while I was enrolled in this course because, again, I wanted to prove myself as best as I possibly could. And after having known the reality as it stood in front of me at that time, I made a decision to do what was in my power. So I started workshopping my resume, my portfolio, applying for jobs, networking way earlier than my graduation point when I would legally be allowed to work, and to get all of my paperwork in order and have my eligibility to not have that slow me down in any way or form. And I remember I started applying for jobs back in January when my graduation date was in May. And a lot of the responses I got were, you're applying too early, let's circle back in a few months, which obviously from an employer standpoint, I 100% understand, because no one wants to hire someone 6 months out, 5 months out. But I did this whole process. So the other stipulation is OPT is not just a given. So that is something that you also have to apply for after graduating and getting your degree. And to do so, you have to fill out a form, submit a fee, you know, and a letter from the university stating that you are completing your program, that you are in good standing, and you are receiving a degree at so-and-so date. At the end of that process, USCIS goes through your application and provides you with an employment authorization document, which essentially states that you're legally allowed to be working in this country. I did all of my paperwork and applied for this document. You have to give a start date or your potential employment start date that will be printed on this almost license-like digital card that will be sent to you. And you cannot legally start working for that point. However, from the date printed on that document, you have a 60-day period to secure a job. Otherwise, it's not eligible anymore. And I applied for this at the end of January, preemptively, very optimistically thinking that I will be able to secure a job for the starting date that I put on that card, which was mid-June. And I must have done something right. I went through various interview processes where, as an international student, you can have the best resume and the best portfolio, but at the end, they come to a question, which is, do you require sponsorship? And if the answer is yes, a lot of the times they don't even ask further questions because it's an added investment for any employer, which as a fresh graduate, they don't see it a lot of the times as worth the hassle, because even if they go through all of that, it's not guaranteed. It is a lottery. So I went through so many interview at the end phased, but no, sorry, we cannot support you with this. Which again, I understood that this was going to be a difficult mountain to climb when I started on this journey, and I kept at it. I did eventually secure a job at a renowned Chicago architecture office and talked to them about, this is the date that I put on the document. Also, my mom is going to be visiting me for graduation and I would like to spend some time with her. So I want a few weeks just to decompress before I jump into this job. And they very well agreed. They liked me enough. That's the date that they put on my employment contract. And we're at the graduation ceremony and everyone's making small talk about just the journey that we've gone through and, you know, what we've learned, what's the next steps. And I realized that people have already received or started receiving their EAD, which is the employment authorization document. And I kept on checking my mail, but I did not have it, which was a little concerning because these people had applied for it months after I did. But with USCIS, there is no direct point of contact. There's not even a direct email address that you can write an email to. So I had no option to wait, which I did. As the start of my employment date got closer, I reached out to this employer to let them know that I'm still waiting for this document. If they have any tips, suggestions, recommendations, what I should do, what I can do, to please let me know. I also did reach out to the International Services and Career Services at the university to ask them about it, and they told me to be patient and to wait. And when that day did arrive that I have to stop this job, I still have not received this document. So I went in and spoke to them. What are my options here? What is it that I can do that protects me, but also protects you as an employer? So neither of us are in default of these regulations. They asked me to wait and try and get in touch and see what's the status of this. And they ended up deferring like my employment start date by another couple of weeks. And by this point, as someone who wanted to sink my teeth into the profession of architecture, I have already been removed from it for over a 2-year period. So I kept waiting, but to what end? Till one day I just got tired and went down to the physical office location of USCIS in the city. And because I did not have an appointment or like USCIS government generated emails saying that I have to be in the premises, they did not even allow me inside. And I stood at the door, talked to the guard, till I just turned around and went back home because I didn't know what else to do. And I repeated this again till eventually I went back when the first guard that I had met with was there, and he was a little surprised to see me. And I'd say he took pity and was like, you know what, wait here. I'll go explain to someone what you're looking for and see if someone can provide you answers or at the very least talk to you. So that was incredibly nice of that person. They went in, probably explained my situation, and someone came out, talked to me, and said that it usually takes, the turnaround time should be anywhere between 4 weeks to a couple of months. And since it had been by this point over 5 months, that am I sure I even submitted it? Because it doesn't seem so in their system. And again, this is a very important piece of document that I'm not going to send via just mail. So I have a FedEx receipt saying that it has been received. I have a copy of all of the documents signed that I have submitted, which was just, they claimed that it was never received. So I ended up submitting another application, paying another fee, and sending all of that again. And in this whole process, job offer that I had secured ended up being rescinded. I remember getting that email and it was essentially, you're great. We did like your work. However, we have projects. Somebody needs to work on it. And as much as we empathize and understand your situation, our hands are tied as well. And we needed someone to start yesterday. So all the best to you in your future endeavors, but consider this job offer rescinded.
I can only imagine that, you know, you were just absolutely devastated. I am just heartbroken for you, knowing that you've done everything right in all of these circumstances, you know, and you've done your research and you've asked the right questions. And, you know, with the gentleness and politeness that you even bring to this podcast, not in an accusatory manner, not in, you know, fits of rage, but really just, you know, with that passion and curiosity to, you know, find the way forward. And I'm so sorry that happened. I think, you know, there's usually a point in each of these episodes where we just kind of have to apologize on behalf of our
government, our profession,
countrymen, and our, yeah. And this is that point in the episode. So I'm so sorry that you went through all of that.
Thank you. It means a lot for someone to even acknowledge all of this, because even while I was going through all of these things, you know, just getting hit in every direction, it was hard to even talk about it with anyone, because it just felt like I'm making excuses for my failures in some way or form. And there was a period of multiple days that I just cried in bed, because what am I supposed to do in this situation, which is absolutely out of my control? But again, I picked myself off, dusted myself off, restarted the job search in the hopes that eventually they will get this application and eventually I will receive the work authorization document. And it so happened that at two other practices, I went to the final round of interviews, but because I was not in a position to give them a start date or even like guess one, because I don't know, it's not in my control, those never led to offers, which I don't even know if I would ever have the clarity or the answer, if that was because I wasn't good enough or they didn't want to hire me or because of all of this, the start date jurisdictional thing. Those are answers that I may never get.
And the reality is you did everything you were supposed to do.
And I am not the only international student. I am not the only international student in this particular program. However, these are the challenges that I have come across, which was incredibly disheartening.
You are certainly one of the most resilient guests that we've had on the podcast and one of the most resilient applicants that I've seen in the architectural pool. And after all of this, applying a second time for your EAD, applying to, I'm sure we can't even count the number of postings and firms, and there are so many in Chicago, and I'm sure that, you know, 80% of them heard from you. So at this point, what happens next? Tell us where you go from here, from this sort of limbo that seems everlasting.
I ended up finally receiving this EAD card in September. The start date on that is what I put in the application that I filed the second time around, which is July. It's September already, and I am already at the end of that 60 mark period within which I have to secure a job, because the printed date on this is July when I applied for it. At that point, I was already in talks with multiple places. Any particular office that would be clear for me to apply to, because another stipulation of the OPT and F1 is that it has to be directly related to your course of study. Otherwise, you're not eligible. One of the practices that I was talking to at the time was a design build firm. And it just so happened that they extended an offer a day after I had received this card, which, as I said, this is mid-September, so I am already at the end, almost at the end of that 60-day period. So I didn't even ask questions. I did not even negotiate. at that point, I wasn't even sure if they would apply for my H-1B sponsorship, and I only have a 1 year period. I just signed the offer and I was like, I will see you in the office on Monday. And I just hope that these are all conversations I can have with them once, you know, I like put my head down, do my work, and actually can prove my worth to them, which is exactly what I did.
I'm sweating just listening to this. So I can only imagine how nerve-wracking this was. Tell us about what the job was like.
The job was good, and this is not exactly what I had wanted or hoped to do, but I took it in stride. I'm like, it's a design-build firm, so which is great for, you know, my licensure and getting those requirements because of the types of projects I will be involved potentially in each phase of the process. So not only will I get some like design and planning experience and those, the design development hours, but if I can also prove to them that I can do like construction admin and not just the construction documentation piece, it could help me with that as well and gain those hours too. And that was a very, very helpful piece. I did end up doing pretty well at this job. And I should note that this is still at the time that the industry as a whole is still transitioning from AutoCAD to BIM. And because I did have so much time on my hands, I educated myself on the technologies, on the construction technologies. I taught myself Revit and Navisworks and Dynamo because that is all I could do in the absence of actually doing a job. So that's what I invested in. And that's one of the huge reasons they hired me. I am at a point where I am not just doing my project work, but also training their staff to bring them up to date with like BIM and Revit and help the firm transition to that, which was never part of my contract. But I didn't even ask questions in my head. I'm like, you know what? They see my value in this. And if I can help, again, prove to them that I am indispensable, that works in my favor because they might agree to sponsor my H-1B, which they did. And I made sure to get it in writing. And they did help with that.
At this point, you are likely thrilled for Lara. We certainly were. She has been through so much. She's been so resilient and determined and is finally reaping the rewards. She's got a job at a company that values her and sponsorship for the H-1B. But as a listener of this podcast, you can potentially also imagine that this is not the end of Lara's troubles. In fact, it's just the start of another challenge she has to face as she moves into the working world of architecture.
Trying to be open and social and friendly with an eagerness to learn and teach and absorb everything that I possibly could in this professional environment. I guess there was some miscommunication maybe that happened because one of the partners that I did not directly work with, so my interaction with them was very limited, but I did see myself on the end of unwanted advances from them, which this is my first experience of working in the US. So I tried to keep an open mind that maybe it's just a cultural thing and I might be reading too much into it till a point that it started to get a little physical and I was incredibly uncomfortable with these things. And I remember talking to a friend who is not from the profession, and I saw the look of shock on their face asking me, how have I let this slide and why haven't I flagged this to the HR? There is no HR. This is a like small to medium sized design build firm under 50 people. There is one person who does accounting and operation, who you can go to if you have any other concerns. So there is no concept of HR. The informal structure that I did like initially ended up becoming a noose around my neck, for the lack of a better metaphor, because at this point, there are projects being taken away from people and given to me because I know the workings of it. I know the client. I am faster. So my billable hours are lower. So the profit margins are higher. But I can hear it in a very joking way in informal conversations with my peers that this is happening because this particular partner has an infatuation with me. And who knows what I am doing to get these projects. And that was something that is absolutely unacceptable, especially because I have been working very hard to prove to the company, to prove to the leadership that I am worth the investment of their sponsorship and to go that route. But then because of somebody else's advances, all of that amount to nothing and not even being respected within my peers because of that reason.
I think it's important for us to stop and point out that as much as this is a series of the most unfortunate events and is just a horrendous track record of misses on the part of so many different parties here, it really points out that in our attempt to create a system of meritocracy by which people can come to this country and perform well and be rewarded, we really have created a system that is ripe for abuse and one that encourages exploitation because it has put extremely talented, extremely hardworking, and just downright nice people in a position where they don't have the same means to react, not only because our profession has the worst track record for human resources, we'll just call it general goodness for humans, because at the same time, all of your livelihood that you've built here is at risk. In every stage of this, there is a lingering clock, 60-day clock that is put on you. I mean, first of all, you have your F1 visa that's tied to your time as a student. Then you have your OPT, which is tied to a one-year clock. And that can't start until you get your EAD. And that EAD is turned around, well, maybe in about 2 months. And then, of course, that's linked to your applications. And that is linked to starting these jobs. And starting these jobs is linked to your H-1B application. I think that it's just so important to outline the stressors that we are putting architects under, in addition to it being one of the most stressful professions that could possibly exist. And I just think it's important to tie a bow on this before we, you know, forget that you have been through all of these things and point any kind of finger that you might have let something slide, because this is not about just giving someone the benefit of the doubt, as you so graciously did. It's also about the fact that, as you're alluding to, taking action means putting everything at risk.
The architecture industry as a whole is, I would say, not that large. And it was always my impression, people thought, and if you sling mud at somebody else, it does splash back on you. And as someone very fresh, very green, just starting out my career in this country, I did not want that reputation. So I just kept it to myself. And this is around the time that I had reached sort of a breaking point. And you see me now and today. But if I show you, I had gained 25, 30 pounds. I did not look the same. I didn't want to do anything. I was not socializing. Multiple friends urged me to seek out help. And I did start seeing a therapist, which again is tied to the job because your health benefits are tied to the job. And just the way the hours work and everything, I had to talk to the partnership about leaving half an hour early one day of the week so I could go see this therapist. And at that point, I was asked so many questions. Is everything okay? Why do you need to seek this out? What are you going through? And I kept it very general and superficial and just alluded to there's things in my personal life. But the fact that I had to go even seek help, I had to go through these series of questions. That was not a good time. And again, I'm trying to focus on my career, how I can move forward in that. And something that was incredibly important to me was to get published, because you can be doing the best possible work, but short of marketing it on the company website, how do you you apply for AIA award and different submissions, but how else do you get that out into the world? And I tried to phrase it as, you did see my past publications on my resume, which I'm sure is a part of the reason you did hire me or didn't even invite me in for an interview. So you'd see the value. And I know that, again, it's a design-build firm. You're not in the practice of doing that. This firm is also fairly new, which I understand. I volunteered to do that. And I was told explicitly that, sure, great. It can be on top of your 40-hour billable week, because that's time that's not billable, which I took in stride. Competitions are important because it's a way to get your name out there. And I am not in any position to be on the business development side of things at this point, which I understand, but I kept trying. And Construction, very popular charity build competition, happens all across the country in different cities. I tried to get the partnership on board for that. And I was told, do you want to hold a vote in the studio, see who's all interested, and if you can gather enough interest or gather a partnership with someone that we work with, we can go ahead this route and you can champion it, which I did. So it was, and again, this all top of my billable hours. So I'm working 60, 65-hour weeks at this point, avoiding any and all situations where I am not in the office late. So this particular partner doesn't corner me and I am not subjected to something that I am uncomfortable with. So I started going to the office at 5, 6 a.m. in the morning because I would be the only one there, because that was acceptable to me rather than staying late, because I know what happens when I stay late. And as I am leading this competition project, became increasingly hard for my peers to take me seriously, because according to them, I was just handed this leadership opportunity since this partner has an affinity for me. So it was very discouraging to put in all of this time and effort and not even be respected enough for that. I try to look at the positive of it. It was a great learning experience. It did put the firm's name out there, and that's what I'm choosing to focus on and not everything else that it came with. To the build night, which you get a period of about 10 to 11 hours. You start building it after 7 p.m. and you have until 6 a.m. the next morning to complete this build. So it was incredibly late night, and we've practiced, we have a plan of action, we've put together multiple prototypes by the stage. And after this build was done, I remember it's very late in the night, after 2, 3 a.m., something like that. I remember the team wanting to grab a drink. And again, at that point where no place is open, so you're literally outside with whatever beverages you may have on you. And this partner offered to drive me home, being it's so late and how are you going to get back and things. And I could not even come up with enough excuses to deter their advances till one of my coworkers jumped in and was like, oh, our Uber is here. We live in absolutely different directions of the city, not even close. And they had to jump in and be like, okay, let's go. Our Uber is here. That's what you're waiting for, right? And I have never felt so utterly helpless where I am reliant on the pity of others to be saved.
I just want to recognize that I think up until that point, everyone failed you. You mentioned earlier that all of the stuff that you were doing felt like you had been just failing and not able to get what you were after. But everyone here, up until the one colleague who finally intervened to get an Uber, just utterly failed you. And I think as younger members of this profession, which is what I still consider myself to be, I think it's easy to look up and say that it's leadership's fault, but your peers failed you. And I am just so deeply horrified and upset and hurt for you, but also for folks who could potentially see something like that happening and for the most part be competitive as opposed to compassionate. And I am so deeply disappointed. This profession that I think fosters the competition over the compassion. And I am just so incredibly humbled by your tenacity and your ability to withstand and overcome and survive this. I'm so sorry that you had to, but I am so glad that you did.
I like to think that I came out of all of this on the other side stronger and knowing better what my boundaries are and enforcing them. This, however, was the breaking point. And this is in 2019. That's when I had like saved up some vacation time that I had coming up. And I took a couple of weeks off and I was traveling. So I just, by that point, I'd become very familiar with solo traveling. And I went to Australia, just as far away from everything I know I can see, clear my head to get a better sense of what I want out of life, what my priorities are, who I am, and how am I going to get there. And that was very, very helpful. I came back. By this point, I have already been at this practice for over 3 years, including my 1 year of OPT. Somehow I was fortunate enough to get picked in the H-1B lottery. So I have been at this practice for over 3 years at this point. And it's difficult getting a new job because you have to find someone who will still sponsor you. It just like the sponsorship gets transferred over, which also is an additional cost for any employer. I realized all of that. And I realized that, again, that whole process was not going to be easy, but that is just a step I am going to have to take. And I came back, the holiday season came up in the new year. I started applying for new jobs. And around the time, I had just started to interview, network, talk to recruiters, get the word out. That's when the pandemic happened and the world shut down. And across the industry, that was not so much a hiring freeze in those exact terms, but that's where there was no more hirings at the time. This had, you know, like passed over, or the pandemic as we saw at that time in March 2020. But also for myself to have a backup option, I put a world map on my wall and compiled a list of places, countries, cities that I would be okay with living in, that I could still go and practice and not have to start from scratch all over again, initially when I was job hunting. But it's now July 2020, the pandemic is still going strong with no signs of slowing down. And I survived the first two rounds of layoffs at this firm, but by the third round, so it's August 2020, I did get laid off.
This is so stressful. And you lived it, and we're just hearing about it.
And if you've listened to previous episodes of this podcast, you know already what that means.
When you're on an H-1B visa, if you lose your job or sponsorship, that's when the clock starts again, and you have a 60-day period to find a new employer, a new sponsorship, or pack your bags and buy. By this point, at that design build firm, I was working with a client that was doing development all across North America, so US, Canada, and Mexico. So I had been working with certain Canadian local architects for some of the project locations in different cities in Canada. And that seemed like the easiest move and transition, where I would still have to take a few steps back in order to go forward. But that was where the transition would be the easiest. And also when the rate of development and growth, it seemed like I had a better future there. By this point, I have vowed to not let any employer or any country have more authority or say on my future than myself. Here, I could apply on basis of merit and not have had to ask an employer for sponsorship, which was the biggest check mark in that box. And that my backup option. And this is in the middle of pandemic. No matter how many jobs I applied to, no matter how many recruiters I talked to, there was just no hiring. So there's nothing I could do. But during this whole process, I had already submitted my documents and paperwork for the Canadian permanent residency, which I could do as an individual on basis of merit. But again, the pandemic, so that is in process. And for multiple years, I had been working with an immigration lawyer, not a company lawyer, one that I hired as an individual to watch out for my interests, not the company's interests. It was not cheap, but as I saw it, it was an investment in my future and present. And I needed someone to have my back. And the lawyer was able to help me stay in the country without a job. They did apply for a change of status, knowing very well that I have already applied for my Canadian permanent residency. And there's no reason that that wouldn't come through no matter whatever time it took. So they helped change my status so I could still legally stay in the country without being in default of anything, which I was very incredibly grateful for. Knowing very well that I have closed this chapter of my life, I preemptively started job hunting in Canada in the few cities that I knew I would want to live in. And within a month, I secured a job. Company like wanted someone to start essentially immediately. And the fact that I wasn't even in the country at that time did not faze them, and they had me start remotely. So that's when the second kind of chapter of my professional journey and career began. And yeah, I did learn a lot. I did face a lot of challenges living, trying to work, forge a career path in the US. But this is where the journey ends, because I could not climb that mountain anymore.
Oh, you climbed that mountain. There was just no reason for you to stay on it. Well, I can only imagine trying to live through it. And you tell this story with such grace and such humility that it's inspiring, despite of how awful it must have been. And just so thankful to our friends in the North to welcome you in ways that I guess we just couldn't, which is so disappointing on so many levels. But I'm glad it is at least a happy, hopefully happy, new beginning for you. I won't say ending.
It's no wonder it only took them a month to hire you. You're such a badass. Shout out to Canada for picking up the talent. Oh my God. We cannot thank you enough for taking the time to join us on this episode of Redlines.
Thank you for providing time and the space for me to share this story. Really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this episode of Redlines, subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast streaming service. Don't forget to check out the show notes for relevant links, resources, and other information related to today's story that we hope will help you in your own journey. If you want to hear more of these stories, consider supporting us as an Out of Architecture Patreon subscriber, where you'll have access to exclusive Out of Architecture content, our private community, and more.
And if you or someone you know has a story that you'd like to hear on an episode of Redlines, please send us an email at redlines@outofarchitecture.com. Thanks for listening.